yourself, Greg. None of your political rhetoric has anything to do with what's going on here, so don't muddy the waters. You've dropped a bomb in our laps, and we're doing what we can to adjust to the situation. You and Shelley don't have the right to abuse and insult us. Sean tore into the kitchen again, running full tilt. Deborah reached out a hand and grabbed him by the upper arm. Listen here, you stop that. I won't have you screaming and shrieking while we're having a conversation. Sean stopped in his tracks. He wasn't accustomed to reprimands. He looked from her to Greg. His face crumpled and he burst into tears, his mouth coming open in a howl so profound there wasn't any sound at first. He clutched his penis for comfort, perhaps realizing for the first time how vulnerable he was without clothes on. Deborah couldn't even bear to look at him. When his tears failed to have the desired effect, he added screams.
I hate you! I want my mama! I want my mama!
Deborah waited for his tantrum to subside, but he just revved it up a notch, the tone of his screams climbing up the scale. Greg said, hey, 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 doing what he could to calm him, trying to reason and explain, while Sean collapsed on the kitchen floor. He lay on his back and kicked his feet hard, catching Deborah's ankle in the process. Shit, she said, knowing she'd be bruised for a month. Shelley appeared in the door, the picture of righteous indignation. Her face was puffy and her hair was matted from sleep. She took one look at Sean and turned on Deborah.
What did you do to him? You have no right. How dare you lay a hand on my child? I won't have you interfering with my discipline.
Adopting a pleasant tone, Deborah said, What discipline, Shelley? All I did was tell him to stop running around, shrieking, while Greg and I were in the middle of a conversation. That's common courtesy, though I don't expect you to embrace anything as bourgeois as that.
Bitch!
Shelley grabbed Sean and lifted him, turning on her heel and hurrying him from the room as though saving him from personal assault. Deborah gave Greg a long, cool look, daring him to take Shelley's part.
Jesus, Mom! Now look what you've done!
He shook his head, aggrieved, got up, and left the house. For the next hour, Deborah could hear Shelley out on the bus, yelling and weeping. Accusations, recriminations. She leaned forward and laid her cheek on the cool surface of the kitchen table. Dear God, how would she get through the next 4 months? Chapter 4. Thursday morning, April 7th, 1988. Thursday, I woke up at 6 a.m. and pulled on my running shoes for my 3-mile jog. I brushed my teeth but left the rest of my toilette for the damp morning air. When the weather's hot, the run leaves my hair sweaty, and when it's cool, as it was that day, the fog makes a mess of it anyway. At the beach, the only people I see are as unkempt and baggy-eyed as I am. I don't jog for health benefits, which are probably minimal at best. I do the almost daily 3-mile run for the sake of vanity and peace of mind. I see couples walking or running while they chat, or lone individuals with their headsets in place, listening to God knows what. I crave the quiet, which allows me to sort out my thoughts. Home from my run, I showered, dressed, and grabbed an apple, which I ate in the car. I'd intended to hit the public library first thing, but I put that on hold until I made a visit to Climping Academy. At 10:13, I drove through the 2 stone pillars that marked the entrance to Horton Ravine. I took the first left, turning onto Via Beatrice, a narrow 2-lane road that wound up the hill to the academy, which overlooked a spring-fed lake. The main building was the former residence of a wealthy Englishman named Albert Climping, who arrived in Santa Teresa on his retirement in 1901. Prior to immigrating, he was engaged in the manufacturing of inlet valves and flotation devices for toilets. And while he'd amassed a fortune, the source of his money ruled out acceptance in polite society. At a lawn party, really, how could one converse with a toilet valve magnate? If he was aware that the nature of his livelihood forever barred him from hobnobbing with the Horton Ravine elite, He gave no sign of it. He purchased a hilly 35-acre parcel, which had languished undeveloped near the ravine's front entrance. The property boasted a natural spring, but the general location was deemed undesirable because it was too far from the ocean and too close to town. Undismayed by these deficits, Klimping brought in heavy equipment and excavated a crater-sized containment pond for the spring water that bubbled up out of the hillside. Having created Klimping Lake, he set up an extensive network of water pipes that crisscrossed his land. He flattened the peak on the steepest of two hills and began construction on a fake English manor house, complete with stables, a phony chapel, a barn, and a massive glass conservatory. All the exteriors were clad in a golden sandstone that he had imported from his native Sussex. The interiors featured heavy, ancient-looking beams, coffered ceilings, mullioned windows, and rich 12th-century tapestries he had made in Japan. If there had been an architectural board of review in his day, he would never have been granted approval for this faux medieval domicile, which was completely out of place in an area noted for its one-story Spanish-style homes made of adobe and red tile. Albert Klimping had grown up in poverty with no education to speak of, but he was smart. He was an avid reader, and he had an uncanny understanding of the land. The sweeping views from his hilltop property were astonishing. The Pacific Ocean was visible to the south, and the mountains loomed to the north, with the city of Santa Teresa spreading out between the two. During drought years, Klimping's acreage was always green, supported by an irrigation system that also allowed him to maintain orchards and vegetable gardens sufficient to sustain him. While his perspicacity was undisputed, his humble origins remained a fatal defect. If Klimping thought he could purchase respectability among the carriage trade, he was sorely mistaken. The ladies were prepared to rebuff any overture he might make. Sadly for them, he had no desire to ingratiate himself, and they were left with various biting remarks growing sour on their tongues. For the next 20 years, he went about his business, entertaining foreign dignitaries and Washington politicians, men who appreciated his financial acumen and his lively sense of humor. When he died, a charter school was established out of his estate. Klimping Academy was richly endowed, and from the day the doors opened, the well-to-do parents in Horton Ravine clamored to enroll their kids. Over the years, with the blessings of the city, additional sandstone-clad buildings were erected, all in the same imposing architectural style, which set the school apart from and above its competitors. I pulled into the gravel motor court and found a parking space in an area screened by boxwood hedges. I locked my car and walked around to the front entrance, where I climbed a flight of low stone steps and entered the main building. While the grand architectural elements were still in evidence, the interior had been updated and furnished with all the modern conveniences. I paused to read the school's mission statement, which had been framed and hung just inside the doorway. In support of its claims of scholastic excellence, the school boasted that 100% of Klimping graduates went on to college. I had to read that line twice. 100%? Well, shit. Maybe if I'd attended Klimp, I wouldn't have wasted my education smoking dope with a tatty bunch of ne'er-do-wells at the public high school. A class bell rang and students began to spill out into the corridor. I stood and watched them passing in twos and threes. I did envy them, but I could feel an old prejudice rising to the surface. I wanted to believe the offspring of the rich were snooty and spoiled, but such was not the case. These kids were friendly, well-behaved, and conservatively dressed, no flip-flops, no cut-offs, and no t-shirts imprinted with offensive expletives. Some actually smiled at me, and a few said hi. They were disconcertingly nice. On the other hand, why wouldn't they be nice when they sailed through the world with all the advantages? Behind closed doors, they were probably subject to the same miseries as everyone else, parents whose alcoholism, financial scandals, divorces, and emotional shenanigans left them as vulnerable as the children of the middle class and the poor. Money couldn't possibly protect them from all of life's woes. On the other hand of my first other hand, whatever their problems, whether inherited or self-generated, their parents could at least afford the best doctors, the best lawyers, and the most exclusive rehabilitation facilities. I beckoned to a passing student. "Excuse me, can you tell me where I can find the library?" She was a good-sized girl, built like an athlete with a sturdy set of bones. Her dark hair was straight and sleek, pulled into a complicated knot at the nape of her neck. When she smiled, her braces gleamed. "Sure, I'm headed in that direction anyway." "Thanks." We walked the length of the corridor and turned right. She left me in the hallway outside the library while she continued to her next class. The room I entered must have been the mansion's original library. Shelves of books extended from floor to ceiling on all four walls, with a movable platform ladder resting against a brass rail. The panes in the leaded glass windows were marked by imperfections, lending a shimmering effect to all the outside views. Two groups of students sat in dark green leather chairs arranged around refectory tables. The students were quiet, and there wasn't much activity, except for the turning of pages and the scribbling of pens. The librarian was seated at a desk under one of the windows. The name plaque in front of her read, "Lori Cavallero, Head Librarian." She looked up at me expectantly. She set her pen aside, got up, and crossed the room, walking on the balls of her feet to minimize the sound. She appeared to be in her late 40s, her dark hair a long, careless tumble around her face. Her mouth was bracketed with deep lines, and a faint frowning V was sketched between her eyes. She wore a long brown knit dress over boots, her sleeves pushed up to her elbows. "Are you Ms. Cavallero?" She smiled. "Yes, I'm Kinsey," I said with a smile to match hers. "I was wondering if I might take a peek at the 1967 yearbook. I'm trying to track down an old friend." "Of course. We keep the yearbooks in the other room. You want to follow me?" "Great," I said. I couldn't believe another closely held conviction was taking a hit. Now it turned out the faculty and staff were as nice as the kids. What was Sutton's problem? She moved to a door on our left and ushered me into the room. "This was Albert Klimping's study," she said. She gave me a moment to appreciate the room and its furnishings. The study was smaller than the library and beautifully proportioned, with a spiral staircase taking up one corner. I counted 20 built-in file drawers, each labeled with old-fashioned cursive on white card slipped into brass frames. I could see wide, shallow drawers that I imagined held maps or documents intended to be stored flat. A massive desk took up the center of the room, resting on an oriental carpet in muted browns and blues. A big stone fireplace with an impressive carved mantel was centered in the wall across from the door. On the far wall, there was a second carved wooden door, probably leading to the hall beyond. The remaining wall was paneled in mahogany. The oil portraits that hung in the open spaces between bookshelves were darkened with age and suggested successive generations of severe Christian gentlemen and their long-suffering mates. "Wow," I said, in all sincerity. From my perspective, the prime item of interest was the spiffy-looking copy machine I'd spotted just inside the door. "The yearbooks are on the bottom shelf," she said. "I'll be in the other room if you need anything else." "Thanks." She moved into the larger room and closed the door. And just like that, I was given access to the information I thought would require a mandate from the California State Senate. I dropped my shoulder bag near the copy machine and crossed to the shelves where the yearbooks were lined up. The 1967 edition was there, and I toted it with me, riffling through pages while I activated the on button and waited for the machine to warm up. The first 25-plus pages were devoted to the graduating seniors, half-page color headshots with a column beside each photograph, indicating countless awards, honors, offices, interests. The juniors occupied the next 15 pages, smaller photographs in blocks of four. I flipped over to the last few pages where I found the lower school. which included kindergarten through fourth grade. There were three sections for each grade, 15 students per section. The little girls wore soft, red and gray plaid jumpers over white shirts. The boys wore dark pants and white shirts with red sweater vests. By the time these kids reached the upper school, the uniforms would be gone, but the wholesome look would remain. I turned the pages until I found the kindergartners. I checked the names listed in small print under each photograph. Michael Sutton was in the third grouping, front row, second from the right. His eyes were big and brown and worried even then. Most of his classmates towered over him. His teacher's name was Louise Sudbury. I looked for the two other Michaels, Borman and Troutwine. Michael Borman was a towhead, a goofy grin showing a blank where his two front teeth had been. Michael Troutwine was heavyset, with a round face and a crown of dark curly hair. All the boys wore shoes that were comically large compared to their bony little six-year-old legs. The copy machine wasn't old, but it was slow. Nonetheless, my visit to the library and my return to the parking area, photocopies in hand, was accomplished in a snappy 15 minutes. I couldn't believe my good fortune. Things seldom went this swimmingly for me, which should have been a clue. Chapter 5. The home address Sutton had given me was 2145 Hermosa Street, on the west side of town. His was a neighborhood of condominiums and single-family residences, many of which were rentals. The houses tended to be small and plain, with stucco exteriors and shallow pitched asphalt roofs. Frame bungalows were tucked between two-story apartment complexes, devoid of architectural interest. Mature trees towered over the tenth of an acre lots on which they'd been planted, suggesting a lack of vision on the part of those first owners, who'd apparently failed to recognize that after 45 years of California rain and sun, a red gum sapling or a 2-foot spruce would dominate the front yard and dwarf the modest house it was meant to ornament. I slowed, scanning the progression of house numbers on a stretch of pinched-looking one-story board-and-batten cottages. The exterior of 2145 Hermosa was painted a gaudy yellow, the window frames and trim outlined in royal blue. The effect was not as cheerful as one might hope. The strong hues only emphasized the cheap construction and the sad state of disrepair. Above the small covered porch, a square window suggested habitable attic space, which would be unbearably hot and stuffy in the summer months, and cold and damp at any other time of year. To the right of the wooden porch steps, a mass of pink snowball bushes obscured one of the two front windows. To the left, the thorny paddles of a prickly pear cactus had fanned out in a configuration that rendered the narrow side yard impassable. I found a parking space, locked my car, and walked back to the house. Ordinarily, locking my car was more cautionary than critical, but not in this area. Hermosa came to a dead end at the 101, which was visible through a bare patch of wire fence that was otherwise blocked by weeds. Freeway traffic kicked up a buffeting wind, accompanied by an eddy of exhaust fumes. Trash had been sucked up against the fence where the rush of passing cars created a vacuum. How did a kid raised in Horton Ravine end up in a neighborhood as crummy as this? When Climping Academy boasted about entire graduating classes going on to college, there wasn't any mention of what came afterward. I'd always imagined a high-toned education guaranteed an equivalent high-toned lifestyle. But I lived better than this guy, and what was that about? I went up the porch steps and knocked on the screen, turning to continue my visual survey while I waited. The two houses directly across the street from Sutton's had been torn down, and someone had taken advantage of the empty double lot to offer off-street parking for $10 a week. This was enterprising, as parking at the curb was free. Every house I saw had iron grillwork secured across the windows to deter the burglars, who probably had the good sense to burgle the pricier houses in town. When I heard the front door open, I turned. Sutton stood behind the screen, wearing the same shirt and tie I'd seen him in the day before. His dark brown eyes conveyed the usual unspeakable gloom. He said, "Oh, hi. I didn't expect to see you so soon. Sorry to stop by unannounced, but there's something I want you to take a look at. I was just on my way out. I have a doctor's appointment. This won't take long. A minute tops." By way of reply, he held open the screen door. I crossed the threshold and stepped into his front room. The light was muted, filtered through the pink hydrangea blooms that crowded against the window glass. The air smelled of bacon, scorched coffee, spilled beer, cigarettes, and dog hair. A golden retriever lumbered to its feet to greet me, long tail banging against an overstuffed chair. The room was too small to accommodate an animal that size. Dogs need a yard to wander in and a shady spot where they can curl up and snooze. A retriever might also appreciate the opportunity to actually retrieve something like a ball or a stick. I've never even owned a dog, and I knew that much. There was a rail-thin girl stretched out on the sofa in shorts and a tank top, bra visible through the fabric. Her bare legs were thrown over the arm of the couch, treating me to a view of the blackened soles of her feet. She was pretty in a pouty sort of way. Her dark hair was long and her eyes were lined and smudged with coal. She wore flashy dangle earrings that sparkled when she moved her head. A full ashtray rested within reach, but happily for me, she wasn't smoking just then. There were three beer cans on the coffee table, two of them empty and lying on their sides. Languidly, she extended her hand, picked up the third can, and took a long swallow before she put it back again. I could see a series of overlapping circles on the tabletop where she'd placed the can. If I counted rings, I could recreate the timeline of her alcohol consumption. Expressionless, she snapped her fingers and the dog crossed the room and settled on the floor close by. I looked at Sutton, anticipating an introduction, but none was forthcoming. I'm reluctant to discuss a client's business in front of someone else, especially in a circumstance like this, when I had no clear sense of their relationship. I wasn't sure what he'd told her or how much I was at liberty to reveal. Sutton said, "So, what's up?" I glanced at the girl. "Would you prefer to talk on the porch?" "This is fine. She's cool." I opened the flap on my shoulder bag and removed the pages I'd photocopied, handing them to him. "Take a look at these and see if you spot the kid whose house you visited." He stared at the photographs, holding them close to his face. I watched his attention shift from face to face. He pointed and said, "That kid." I peered over his shoulder. "Which one?" "Him. I remember now." He indicated a kindergartner in the middle of the top row, a thatch of dark hair, receding chin, ears that protruded like the handles of a jug. "Are you sure?" "Of course. His name's Billy Kirkendall. I hadn't thought of him in years. His dad embezzled all this money, but it didn't come to light until the family left town. Overnight, they were gone. It was like this big disgrace. Does this help?" "Absolutely. The address won't be hard to find unless Kirkendall was his bio dad and the couple got divorced. If his mother remarried, we'd have no way of knowing who his stepfather is. Borman would know. He was always good at stuff like that. He's the one who organizes our reunions, not that I go," he added in haste. He checked his watch. "I have to run." He held up the picture. "Can I keep this? I'll make a copy for my files and get it back to you." Sutton returned the photograph and picked up his car keys. The girl on the couch watched us, but Sutton didn't say a word to her. I trailed out the door after him, and we trotted down the steps together. I said, "Give me a call when you're free, and we'll pay a visit to the Kirkendall property. Maybe you'll find the spot you were talking about." "I'll be home in an hour and a half. I can call your office then." "Good," I said. "Mind if I ask about the girl in there?" "That's Madeline. She was a heroin addict, but now she's clean. She needed a place to crash." "And the dog?" "She belongs to Madeline. Her name's Goldie Hawn." We parted company with the usual insignificant pleasantries. Sutton turned to the left angling up the driveway to the point where his car was parked, while I turned in the opposite direction. Once in the Mustang, I fired up the engine and waited until Sutton passed in his car before I pulled out. He drove a banged-up turquoise MG that dated probably from his high school days. As long as I was downtown, I covered the 7 blocks to Chapel, where I hung a left, and drove 8 blocks up, then crossed State Street and took a right onto Anaconda. Half a block later, I turned into the entrance of the parking facility adjacent to the public library. I waited by the machine until the time-stamped parking voucher slid into my hand, and then cruised up 3 levels until I found a slot. The elevator was too slow to bother with, so I crossed to the stairwell and walked down. I emerged from the parking structure, crossed the entrance lane, and went into the library. The reference department was directly ahead. The wall-to-wall carpet was a dusty rose with a muted pattern of teal-green dots. The chairs were upholstered in the same teal-green. Light flooded in through 6 tall arched windows on the far wall. Most of the tables were empty except for a lone man playing himself in a game of chess. In the fiction department to my left, an assistant librarian shelved novels from a cart piled high with books. At the nearest empty table, I set my shoulder bag on one of 6 empty chairs. On the wall to my immediate right, the floor-to-ceiling shelves were lined with telephone directories for numerous California cities and towns. The shelves below were filled with additional phone books from assorted cities across the country. I circled the periphery in search of the Polk Directory, the Haines, and the 6 decades' worth of Santa Teresa City directories that I knew were housed nearby. The Polk and the Haines are both crisscross directories that offer a means of discovering and cross-referencing the name, address, and occupation of any individual or business in a given area. Where the target is a business, you can also determine the number of people employed and any relevant sales figures. If, as in my case, all you have is a name, you can usually find the person's home address. If all you have is an address, you can pick up the name of the occupant. By shifting to the city directory, you can check the list of residents against a 2nd alphabetical listing of street addresses. The house numbers are sequential, providing the name and phone number of the resident at any particular address. While the information is redundant, each category supplies tidbits that can be pieced together to form a quick sketch. I pulled both the Polk and the Haines for 1966, and then selected 3 city directories, 1965, 1966, and 1967, which I carried to the table. I moved my shoulder bag to the floor and pulled up the chair. From the depths of my bag, I removed a notebook and a ballpoint pen. There was only 1 family named Kirkendall: Keith, CPA, and Margie, graphic designer, at 625 Ramona Road. I made a note of the address and added the names and the house numbers of the neighbors on each side. In Horton Ravine, the properties range from 3 to 10 acre parcels, with some larger ones as well. There are no sidewalks, and the houses are set back from the road. I couldn't picture visits back and forth between neighbors or idle gossip across a side yard fence. I'd never seen anyone seated on the porches visible from the road. My guess was that people were more likely to get acquainted by way of church, the country club, or the numerous civic organizations around town. While I was doing a paper search, I looked for Michael Sutton's former address on Via Inez. I copied the house number in my notebook and then switched over to the Polk, where I picked up the old phone number. In 1967, when Mary Claire Fitzhugh was kidnapped, her family lived on Via Dulcinea. Again, in the interest of being thorough, I found the names of the neighbors on each side. After a 21-year gap, much of the information I had gleaned would be out of date, but having the names on hand might save me a return trip. I checked the most recent telephone book and made a note of the 1 listing that was still good. I replaced the various directories and went downstairs to the periodicals department. At the back desk, I asked the librarian for microfilm copies of the Santa Teresa Dispatch, covering the stretch of dates that encompassed the Mary Claire Fitzhugh kidnapping. I wanted to review the news coverage of the crime before I did anything else. Sutton had sketched in certain significant points, but his prime focus was the time frame, and mine was the bigger picture, including details he might have missed. The librarian returned with two boxed rolls of microfilm, dated July 1st through 31st, 1967, and August 1st through 31st, 1967. I took a seat at a nearby table, flipped on the microfilm reader, threaded the reel under the glass plate, and caught the end piece on the roller. I pressed the button and watched news pages whiz by at a rate that made me dizzy. I paused now and then to check the date line at the top of the page, and when I neared the 19th of July, I slowed and began to look in earnest. The kidnapping garnered front-page headlines for the first time on Sunday, July 23rd, and occupied center stage for the following 10 days, though the account in each edition was much the same. It was clear the FBI had kept a tight rein on the information released to the public, which forced the reporters into endless repetitions of the same few facts. The basics were much as Sutton had related, though I picked up several details he hadn't mentioned. Mary Claire vanished on Wednesday morning, July 19th, though the crime wasn't reported until 3 days later. In that interval, which included the whole of Friday and much of Saturday, the police and the FBI had stepped in and put a lock on the case, ensuring that no whisper of the crime reached the public. Events leading up to the abduction were spelled out, but there was little information from that point on. I started taking notes, in part to distract myself from the specifics of what went down. Even in the flat who, what, where, when, and how of journalism, the story made something in my chest squeeze down. What made the sensation worse was the black-and-white photograph of Mary Claire that appeared with every article. Her gaze was so direct. I felt I was looking into her soul. Her smile was sunny, her eyes shaded by pale bangs. The rest of her hair was held back on each side with a plastic barrette. The dress she wore had ruffles down the front, tiny pearl buttons, and puffed sleeves over arms plump enough to kiss. The photographer had given her a stuffed bunny to hold, so the occasion might have been Easter of that year. I remembered reading about her disappearance at the time, but I hadn't understood the enormity of the crime. What had she ever done to warrant the evil that must have been inflicted on her? I knew, without having met the Fitzhughes, that they doted on her, laughed at her unexpected comments, hugged her when injury or disappointment made her burst into tears. I shifted my focus, blotting out the sight of her face. Then I looked again. This was as much of her as I'd ever know, and there was no way to shield myself from the knowledge that she was gone. Her parents would never have peace of mind, even if her ultimate whereabouts were discovered. In some ways, I wasn't sure what difference it would make. She was lost to them, the length and breadth of her life consigned to a few short years, beginning, middle, and end. I forced myself to scrutinize the account of what happened that day. It all sounded so ordinary. The events leading up to her vanishing carried no hint of the horror to come. Mary Claire had been playing on the swing set in the Fitzhughes' backyard while her mother sat on the back porch reading a book. The only sound on that summer day was the stutter of a leaf blower on the property next door. A landscape company had dropped off a one-man crew. She hadn't actually seen him arrive, but she could hear him working his way up the drive, clearing the pavement of grass clippings from the lawn he'd mowed. The phone rang. Mrs. Fitzhugh set her book aside and went into the kitchen, where she picked up the handset mounted on the wall near the door to the dining room. The location of the phone prevented her from maintaining visual contact with the child. But the entire yard was fenced, and there was no reason to think she was at risk. The caller introduced himself, claiming he was a sales representative conducting a brief survey. Mrs. Fitzhugh agreed to answer a few questions. Later, she had no recollection of the caller's name or the name of his company. He hadn't identified the product he was promoting, but his questions were focused on the number of television sets in the house, the number of hours they were turned on, and the family's program preferences. In all, no more than 4 minutes elapsed between the time she took the call and the moment the salesman thanked her and disengaged. When she returned to the porch, she noticed Mary Claire was no longer on the swing. She scanned the yard, sandbox, playhouse, shallow plastic wading pool. But Mary Claire wasn't visible anywhere. Puzzled, but not alarmed, Mrs. Fitzhugh called her name, but received no response. She went back into the house, thinking Mary Claire might have slipped in unseen while her attention was focused on the interview questions. When it became clear Mary Claire wasn't in the house, her mother returned to the yard and circled the perimeter, checking the shrubbery near the back fence. She peered into the playhouse, which was empty, and then continued around the house. She went through the gate, still calling Mary Claire's name, more alarmed as every minute passed. Frantic, she ran next door and knocked at the neighbor's house, but no one was home. Mrs. Fitzhugh returned to the house, intending to call her husband and then phone the police. As she climbed the back steps, she spotted the note that had apparently been left on the side table and consequently fluttered to the floor. The message was block-printed and brief. The kidnapper said her daughter was safe in his keeping and would be returned unharmed in exchange for $25,000 in cash. If the Fitzhughes made any attempt whatever to contact the police or the FBI, the kidnappers would know and Mary Claire would forfeit her life. All of this became public knowledge 4 days after the child had been taken. In the interim, the FBI questioned Mary Claire's parents, who were white-faced and stunned. After the news broke, neighbors, friends, and acquaintances were interviewed, many of them more than once. The case attracted its share of national attention because it involved the only child of a prominent Santa Teresa couple. After the first splash, however, the coverage became repetitive, which suggested that the FBI had cut off the stream of information to the media. No FBI agent was referred to by name, nor was there any mention of investigators at the local level. The Santa Teresa Police Department's community relations officer issued a statement from time to time, reassuring the public that the investigation was ongoing and that every effort was being made to identify the suspects and recover the child. As with any major crime, certain critical details were withheld from the public, leaving the investigators a means of weeding out the off-kilter citizen driven by a need to confess. There was no further reference to suspects or persons of interest, though detectives must have combed the area, talking to pedophiles, registered sex offenders, and anyone else whose criminal history seemed relevant. The FBI received tips, sightings of the child in places all across the country. There were also countless calls reporting suspicious behavior on the part of strangers who'd done no harm at all and whose actions were innocent. Mary Claire Fitzhugh had been swept into the inky void, and there was no coming back. Since that time, the papers had run a version of the same article year after year in hopes that something would break. Other kidnapped victims were mentioned, anticipating the possibility that someone might recognize a detail and put it together with other facts previously unknown. If Mary Claire was lost, her plight might provoke a confession in another case. For the child herself, the prospects were bleak, and had been once the first 24 hours had passed without word. At least I understood now why Michael Sutton had been so anxious to unravel the significance of what he'd seen. For my part, the thought of the child's fate was enough to make me ill. Chapter 6. Deborah Unruh, July 1963. For the next 3 months, the mother-to-be ate so poorly she gained fewer than 15 pounds. Her diet consisted largely of beans and rice. A perfect protein, she proclaimed, completely disregarding her unborn baby's need for proper nutrition. She didn't believe in prenatal vitamins, claiming that women since the beginning of time had managed to conceive and bear children without the interference of the pharmaceutical companies. Patrick found her attitudes infuriating, but there was no arguing the point. She interpreted any opposition or rebuttal as an assault on her autonomy. He finally threw his hands up and took to leaving the room the minute she walked in. Most of the time, she kept a sullen distance, but there were moments when she made a minor effort to get along, thus fostering Deborah's hopes that a bond could be forged, however limited it might be. Her optimism was always short-lived. Shelley's mood would darken. The unstable elements in her personality would combine, setting off the inevitable explosion. Once she blew up, Greg stepped into the role of mediator, traveling back and forth between the bus and the house. He made excuses, soothing and mollifying first Shelley and then his parents. Deborah almost preferred Shelley's hysteria to Greg's pathetic attempts to broker a peace. Patrick and Deborah took to eating dinner with friends on Friday nights at the Horton Ravine Country Club. According to the gossip, many couples in their social set were experiencing the same dismay as their offspring, now young adults, got caught up in alternative lifestyles, which meant dope, secondhand clothes, long, unkempt hair, and a neglect of personal hygiene. The nights out were their only relief from the tensions at home and their only opportunity to blow off steam. They'd known Kip and Annabelle Sutton since they'd joined the country club shortly after moving to Santa Teresa from Boulder, Colorado. The Unruhs were in their 40s, while Kip and Annabelle were 10 years younger, with school-age children who took up a major portion of their time and energy. For the Suttons, the Friday night get-together was a welcome respite from parental responsibilities. Kip was an architect who specialized in commercial properties, office buildings, banks, department stores. Annabelle was a stay-at-home mom, just as Deborah had been in her day. The Suttons' four children were 2, 6, 8, and 10, the oldest a girl named Diana. During the first round of martinis, the subject of Greg and Shelley came up as it did most Friday nights. Patrick said, "Take a lesson from us. These kids are malcontents, and they're spoiling for a fight. Our accomplishments are worthless as far as they're concerned. You too have the same trouble coming up, only I'm betting it gets worse." Annabelle said, "Don't say that. I have my hands full coping with the terrible twos. Michael was a doll until his second birthday, and now here we are, turning to drink." She plucked an olive from her martini, popped it in her mouth, and then drained her glass. Kip said, "I don't see this business with Greg and Shelley as anything new. Kids have always been rebellious at that age, haven't they?" Patrick shook his head. "Not like this." "Shelley's a beatnik," Deborah said. "She told me she lived for months in a crash pad in North Beach, where all the cool cats hung out." "A beatnik? That's passé, isn't it?" "Not to hear her tell it. She claims she screwed Allen Ginsberg and Lawrence Ferlinghetti in the same 6-day period." Annabelle looked askance. "She actually told you?" "Oh, sure. Proud as punch. I could see she was hoping I'd recoil in horror so she could accuse me of being uptight and out of it. I just sat there and blinked and then asked if she'd ever had the clap." Annabelle cracked up.
"What did she say?"
"She said that wasn't the point. She was experiencing life to the fullest, which was more than I could say." Patrick said,
"I hadn't heard that bit. Where was Sean all this time while she was getting it on?"
"They were all there together. Kids, moms, strangers, potheads, and heroin addicts. They played guitars and bongo drums and made money writing poems they sold to tourists on the streets." Patrick finished his drink and signaled the waitress for another. Kip raised his hand as well, like two guys bidding on the same lot at an art auction. Patrick shook his head in exasperation. "What's wrong with these kids? You give them the best of everything, and they end up spitting in your face. This girl knows it all. You should hear her mouth off. She doesn't have a brain in her head, and she's got the gall to criticize the President of the United States like she has a clue. She can't even run her own life. They're vegetarians, for God's sake. Do you know how much time and energy that takes?" Annabelle said, "More than I'd be willing to expend. I guess you have to give her credit. I couldn't manage it." "Oh, please. You think Shelley cooks? No, ma'am. She refuses to subordinate herself. Deborah's the one saddled with all the meals. You ask me, it's just one more form of narcissism, making everybody jump to their tune while they sit there thinking they're above it all." Annabelle said,
That's ridiculous. Why don't you make them fix their own meals?
My point, exactly. Ask her, he said, hooking a thumb in Deborah's direction.
You know what she eats, Patrick. If it were up to her, every meal would be soy cakes, sprouts, and brown rice.
Sean would starve to death if I didn't give him peanut butter sandwiches behind her back.
You should see him wolf down his food. He's like an animal.
The waitress set down two fresh drinks along with a basket of Parker House rolls and a plate of individual butter pats. Kip turned to Annabelle.
Sorry, I should have asked. Do you want another martini or you want to switch to wine? I better lay off. I'm embarking on a new exercise program, a half-mile ocean swim 3 mornings a week.
Starting on a Saturday? You're not serious.
I am. I leave the kids with a sitter. It's the only time I have for myself.
Must be freezing. You get used to it. Deborah said, I'll make the sacrifice and drink her wine as long as you're ordering. It's the least I can do. Kip asked the waitress for a bottle of Merlot, pointing to his selection on the wine list before he surrendered it. Deborah raised her hand.
Here's one I almost forgot. Yesterday, I found Shelley sobbing her heart out. It was the first emotion I'd seen that wasn't anger, petulance, or disdain. I thought maybe she missed her mother, but when I asked, she said Sylvia Plath had killed herself 6 months ago to the day.
Annabelle said,
Who?
A poet, Patrick said. She was mentally ill. Annabelle shrugged and chose a roll from the basket. She pulled off one segment and buttered it. She took a bite and tucked the nugget of bread into one side of her cheek, a move that slightly muffled her speech.
We know a couple who claim to be vegetarians. Talk about tedious. We had them over for dinner once, and I served macaroni and cheese. After that, I was stumped. They invited us back for a sumptuous bowl of vegetarian chili. The worst. Inedible. Not even close. What got me was they were wearing leather shoes. I voted to drop them, and Kip was opposed.
Until I told him he'd have to cook for them if they ever came back. That set Patrick off again. Here's the kicker as far as I'm concerned. Shelley doesn't like vegetables. The only vegetable she'll eat is beans. She doesn't like fruit either. She says bananas are disgusting and apples make her teeth hurt. She's got a list of food no-nos that includes just about everything known to man, except quinoa, whatever the hell that is.
Kip was shaking his head. Why do you put up with her?
Deborah said.
She's carrying our grandchild. How can we turn our backs on her without rejecting an innocent child? Would you do that?
I guess not, he said. Well, I might, but Annabelle would have my hide. There was a pause while they studied their menus and decided what to have. Salads, rare New York strips, and baked potatoes with sour cream, green onion, and grated cheese. Once the waitress took their order, Patrick returned to the subject.
It wouldn't be so bad if she weren't so opinionated and superior. She looks down her nose at us. We're materialistic and shallow. Everything we do is bourgeois. She talks about the proletariat. God save the queen.
Annabelle made a face.
And Greg goes along with it?
She's got him under her thumb. He sits there with his mouth hanging open, acting like she's reciting from the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, Patrick said. And you know what else? She smells. She doesn't brush her teeth. She doesn't believe in shaving under her arms or anywhere else. She's got leg hair that looks like beaver pelts. I don't see how he can stand being in the bus with her. Every time she leaves the room, we have to spray.
Kip and Annabelle were both laughing by then. She said,
Oh, Patrick, you're terrible.
I kid you not. Ask Deborah if you don't believe me.
Kip lifted an eyebrow, his tone skeptical.
I hate to say this, kids, but I think your mistake was giving Greg too much. How else did he come up with this attitude of entitlement?
Patrick held a hand up.
You're right. You're right. Deborah and I have talked about that.
He paused, looking up as the waitress arrived at the table with the wine. She turned the bottle so Kip could read the label, and once he approved, she proceeded to open it. Kip sampled it, nodded, and said,
Very nice.
Annabelle covered her glass, and once the other three were filled, Patrick picked up where he'd left off.
We both worked our way through college. Deborah's family didn't have the money, and mine thought I wouldn't appreciate the value of an education unless I'd earned it myself. Frankly, the whole thing was a grind. I carried a full load, plus working 20 hours a week. We wanted Greg to focus on his classes, so we told him we'd pick up the tab as long as he kept his grades up. So much for that. 2 years of college, and now he's a dropout and a bum. Annabelle said, "What are they living on? I hope you're not giving them money along with everything else." "Not so far, though I wouldn't put it past Greg to expect financial support," Deborah said, "which they get in any event. They don't pay rent, and we're providing food and all utilities. They don't drive the bus because they can't afford the gas." "Dollars to donuts, he's selling grass," Kip said. Patrick looked at him. "You think?" "Wow, that's worrisome," Deborah said. "They're certainly smoking it. I can smell it halfway across the yard." Annabelle made a face.
"They smoke dope in front of the little boy?"
"Why not? They do everything else in front of him," Deborah said. "Shelley wants him in the delivery room with her so he can experience the miracle of childbirth. That'll be a cheery scene." "What if they're busted selling pot?" Kip asked, harking back to his point. Deborah smacked at Kip's hand. "Would you stop that?" "No, I'm serious," he said. "Suppose the cops get wind of it. I'm just pointing out the kind of trouble you'd be in. For one thing, Child Protective Services would step in and yank that little kid right out of there." "He's not Greg's. Shelley made that clear," Patrick said. Deborah said, "None of this is his fault. He can be a pill, but it still breaks my heart watching the neglect. She has no concept of parenting."
"Isn't he in school?" Annabelle asked.
"She doesn't believe in the public school system. She feels that's just one more form of government propaganda, so she's teaching him herself." Patrick said, "Jesus, we can't keep talking about this. It's ruining my appetite." Annabelle held up her water glass. "Let's look at the bright side. I propose a toast to the baby." "Hear, hear," Patrick said. The four clinked their glasses together. "May all your surprises be little ones," Kip added. But the surprise was Shelley's. The baby was born 2 weeks before her due date. Neither Greg nor Shelley told his parents she'd gone into labor. When her water broke, he took her to the emergency room at Santa Teresa Hospital and settled Sean in the waiting room with a pad of paper and a box of crayons. Initially, there was some confusion because Shelley didn't have an attending physician, medical records, or health insurance. The nurse asked Greg a series of questions, including his occupation, employer, and work address. Once she found out he was unemployed, she pressed him on the issue of who would be responsible for the hospital charges. Shelley was incensed and kicked up such a fuss that the nurse threatened to call security. The two were left alone in the patient bay with the curtain pulled around it for privacy. Greg didn't see that they had any choice but to call his parents and ask for help. Shelley pitched the same fit she always pitched. Greg tuned her out. The hospital notified the obstetrician on call, and he was there within the hour. There was a murmured conference at the nurse's station before the doctor came into the cubicle. He introduced himself as Dr. Franz. Greg was asked to wait in the hall while he did a pelvic exam. Greg went back to the waiting room to check on Sean, who was watching television, an activity ordinarily forbidden. Greg returned to the admissions desk and asked to use the phone. He called his parents and told them what was going on. Patrick asked to speak to the admissions clerk, and he apparently convinced her that all charges would be covered, saying he and his wife were on their way down. Greg returned to the curtained cubicle where he could hear Shelley shrieking at the doctor, telling him where he could stick his fucking finger in his fucking rubber glove. A nurse at the far end of the hall turned and gave him a look. Greg closed his eyes. He wished, just once, she acted like a normal human being. Everything was a fight. Everything was a major uproar. He was exhausted by the strain of trying to soothe and contain her fury. The doctor pulled the curtain aside and asked Greg to come in. Shelley's feet were out of the stirrups by then, and she was sitting on the gurney with the sheet pulled around her and tucked under her arms, so furious she refused to look at either one of them.
The nurse busied herself, studiously avoiding Greg as well. Dr. France told them the presentation was breech, buttocks first, legs folded in front. He suggested a C-section, but Shelley was vehement about a vaginal birth. It was her right. Nobody could tell her what to do. The doctor was carefully neutral, his face blank. He acceded to her wishes, for the moment, as he put it. Shelley said, ha, 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 to his back. Greg thought the guy would turn around and punch her, but he continued down the hall, his heels clicking smartly on the polished tile floor. She was admitted. After the nurse attached her hospital band, she put Shelley in a wheelchair to take her upstairs to the labor and delivery unit. Greg accompanied them as far as the elevator and waited until the door closed before he returned to the waiting room. The quiet was a blessing. Deborah and Patrick arrived. By then, Sean was curled up asleep on a plastic chair in one corner. Patrick took him back to the house while Deborah went up the elevator with Greg and sat with Shelley for the next 4 hours. Twice, the doctor managed to turn the baby, but the baby flipped right back. Deborah had to give Shelley credit for the fact that she endured hard labor without uttering a peep. Of course, she was putting both herself and the baby at risk. After 13 hours, when little or no progress had been made, Dr. France laid down the law. Deborah was allowed to remain in the room while he explained the impasse. If the fetus was born bottom first, there was a possibility the body would fit through the mother's pelvis, but the baby's head would most likely get stuck at the level of the chin. With this condition, known as a trapped head, the possibility of injury was high. Once the baby's body emerged, the umbilical cord would cease to pulsate, which would cut off the oxygen supply. With the baby's head still inside, the infant wouldn't breathe on its own. Without surgical intervention, there was a better than even chance the baby would die. It seemed clear to Deborah there was only one choice. She wanted to shake Shelley until her head rattled. The answer was so obvious. Even Greg was in favor, urging Shelley to consent. By then, she was too worn down to protest. They prepped her for surgery and rolled her into the delivery room. Patricia Lorraine Unruh was born on July 14th, 1963. 6 pounds, 4 ounces, 20 inches long, and bald as an egg. Greg and Shelley called her Rain. Deborah went home and had a stiff drink. Shelley and the baby were in the hospital 3 days. Greg spent most of that time at her side, while Deborah was left to cope with Sean. At first, whatever Deborah suggested, he would voice the doctrine according to his mother, reciting her tenets as an article of faith. It was nearly comical hearing Shelley's sentiments coming from a 6-year-old. Deborah moved ahead without argument, and soon Sean was sharing lunch with her. The two of them had adventures. The botanical garden, the beach, the Museum of Natural History. The boy was not only bright, but interested and quick to learn. Deborah revised her view of him and began to enjoy his company, especially once he went back to wearing clothes. He had a sense of whimsy she hadn't seen before. Shelley came home, still in pain, incapacitated in the aftermath of the cesarean. Deborah offered her the use of the guest room while she recovered. Shelley was fragile and her defenses were down. She moved into the house without putting up a fight while Greg and Sean remained in the yellow school bus. She withdrew, staying under the covers with the curtains in the room pulled shut. She seemed to be suffering postpartum depression, but Deborah realized it was something else altogether. She was humiliated, not angry so much as silenced now that nature had betrayed her and she had nothing to boast about. How could she espouse her many closely held convictions when she'd failed something as elementary as the natural delivery she'd anticipated with such confidence? She'd had the wind knocked out of her sails. In the absence of dogma, she was strangely deflated. Deborah looked on from the sidelines, wanting to reach out, but not daring to do so. Any gesture on her part would signal a compassion that Shelley was ill-equipped to receive. Contributing to the edgy ceasefire was the fact that Rain showed very little interest in nursing. Shelley had breastfed Sean until he was three, so she was an old hand at the process. Rain wouldn't cooperate. She'd whip her head back and forth, mouth barely brushing the nipple. If she finally managed to latch on, she became agitated, arching her back and screaming, red-faced, her fists flailing. After a few days, Shelley had no patience for the feedings. At the first sign of trouble, she'd thrust the baby back at Deborah and turn her face to the wall. Rain went from being fussy to crying non-stop. Deborah knew she wasn't getting enough to eat, but she wasn't sure what to do. Greg appeared at one point. "Is everything okay?" "We're fine. We have a few wrinkles to iron out, but it's nothing to worry about." "Anything I can do?" "Keep Sean occupied, if you would." "Sure, no problem," he said. "Any suggestions about how?" Deborah had to bite her tongue. She already had her hands full and couldn't stop to educate Greg about amusing a child. "Let me give you a few bucks and you can take him to the zoo." Greg frowned. "Did Shelley say it was okay?" "She's asleep. I'm sure she won't object. You might also try the kiddie pool at the beach. He likes to wallow in the water playing hippopotamus. There are lots of other children. He'll have fun." She put in a call to Dr. Irby, a pediatrician she'd met at a cocktail party welcoming new members to the country club. She apologized for the imposition, not wanting to take advantage of their acquaintanceship to ask for free medical advice. She explained the problem as succinctly as she could. Dr. Irby suggested waiting for a couple of more feedings before supplementing with formula. Maybe the baby would get the hang of it and all would be well. By then, Rain's crying was relentless, pitched at a level that would drive any ordinary mortal insane. With Shelley in such a vulnerable psychological state, Deborah was afraid she'd take out her frustrations on the baby. She finally made up 4 ounces of formula and fed Rain herself. Rain settled in to eat, taking the entire 4 ounces before falling asleep. She put the baby in her crib, which they moved into the sewing room down the hall, so Shelley could rest undisturbed if the baby fretted in her sleep. Deborah could remember how attuned she'd been to Greg as a newborn, when any slight sound from the crib would have her on her feet and standing over him. She peered into the guest room where she saw that Shelley was awake. "You can try the breast again when she wakes up. Dr. Irby says some babies take a little longer catching on." "Who gives a shit?" Shelley said, and turned over on her side. Deborah waited for a moment, and when it was clear Shelley wasn't going to volunteer another word, she went downstairs and cleaned up the breakfast dishes. 20 minutes later, the baby started crying again. Deborah heard Shelley's bare feet hit the floor and thump down the hall. Deborah dropped the flatware she was putting in the dishwasher and headed up the stairs, taking them two at a time. Shelley was leaning over the crib.
"God damn it! Shut the fuck up!"
She was just reaching for the baby when Deborah blocked her arm. "I'll take care of her. You rest. Everything will be fine."
"What do you know, you fucking Pollyanna?"
Deborah knew better than to respond. Shelley had reverted to her old ways, and any reassurances would be met with hostility. Shelley stared at her darkly and finally turned on her heel.
"Have at it, Deborah. You think you're so smart, you do it."
She went back into the guest room and shut the door. Deborah picked up the baby and took her downstairs. She settled in the rocker, put a diaper across her shoulder, and laid the baby up against her, patting her gently until she erupted in a satisfying burp. Rain was quiet then. Deborah continued to pat her, humming until the baby drifted off to sleep. She debated about returning her to her crib and thought better of it. Still holding her, Deborah crossed to the wall-mounted phone in the kitchen and lifted the handset. She called Annabelle and gave her a brief account of what was going on. "I need a cradle so I can keep the baby downstairs with me during the day. Do you still have Michael's on hand?"
"Sure. I set aside all of the baby paraphernalia for the next garage sale. I've been letting it sit until I was sure I wasn't going to opt for one more. Let me haul it out and dust it off. I'll be there in a jiffy."
"Don't ring the bell. Come around to the kitchen door and I'll let you in." 15 minutes later, Annabelle pulled into the driveway with Michael in his infant seat next to her, David, Ryan, and Diana in the back seat. She got the kids out of the car, opened the back of the station wagon, and grabbed the cradle by one end. She herded everyone up the drive and around to the back. Deborah was waiting and opened the door before she had a chance to knock. She put a finger to her lips. "Thank you so much," she whispered.
"Not a problem. Anything else I can do to help?"
"This is fine. I'll call you later. You're an angel."
Annabelle blew her a kiss and ushered her brood of kidlets back to the car. There was a delay while she got everyone settled. Deborah heard the car start and caught a glimpse of Annabelle pulling out of the drive. She jiggled the sleeping baby on one arm, using her free hand to carry the cradle into the living room. The thick drapes and wall-to-wall carpeting would muffle Rain's cries if she woke. Maybe with rest, Shelley would feel better able to handle the child. Annabelle had not only dusted the cradle, she'd tucked a crib sheet over the mattress and added a pile of flannel baby blankets at one end. Deborah lowered Rain into the cradle, shook out one of the blankets, and covered her. These were blankets Annabelle made by hand as gifts for the newborns among her friends. She also donated blankets to the nursery at St. Terry's, along with knitted booties and caps, so every new mom, even those without money to spare, would have something warm for her infant to wear home. Deborah returned to her dishes, troubled by the conflict she could see looming on the horizon. She had never understood child abuse. She'd read occasional accounts of babies being shaken to death, babies being beaten and smothered by parents who lacked the patience or maturity to deal with their screaming infants. She'd even read of one young father who took his baby by the feet and swung her against the wall. Now she could see how such atrocities occurred, tempers simmering to a boil. She had no intention of leaving Shelley alone with the child, but she'd have a battle on her hands. Shelley hated interference, hated any action or comment on anyone's part that suggested she was falling short. She also hated being mothered and hated being perceived as needy, which didn't leave many options. Mid-afternoon, Deborah knocked on the guest room door and then opened it a crack. "Would you like some lunch? I can make you a sandwich." Shelley's refusal was scarcely audible. Deborah had nothing else to offer. She fixed a sandwich for herself and sat down in the living room and read a book while she ate. She fed Rain two more bottles of formula at three-hour stretches. Rain was actually settling down, her periods of sleep and hunger falling into a routine. Greg and Sean came in at dinner time, filled with talk of the zoo. Deborah had made a vegetarian lasagna and served it with a bowl of canned peaches and cottage cheese, not a dish she'd ordinarily serve. To her surprise, Sean gobbled up everything on his plate and asked for more. With Shelley gone, the atmosphere at the table was actually pleasant. Now that Sean wasn't subjected to his mother's running comments on the righteous way of doing things, he ate without being threatened or cajoled. After dinner, Deborah cleaned up the kitchen while Greg and Sean remained at the table playing Candyland. The two of them left at 8:30 so Greg could put Sean to bed. Deborah said, "Why don't you fill the tub for Sean before he goes down for the night? I left a container of bubble bath and a stack of fresh towels in the pool house." Sean gave a whoop and was out the door before Greg could get up. He skipped down the steps and galloped across the grass. Deborah gave Greg a kiss on the cheek before he left. Moments later, she saw the lights in the pool house come on. She looked up at the ceiling. Still nothing from Shelley, who was probably too proud to ask for anything, having been so stiff-necked and belligerent to this point. Deborah left the lasagna in the oven. She laid out a plate, a napkin, silverware, and a brief note. If Shelley came down of her own accord, she could fill a plate and take it back upstairs. In the meantime, Deborah moved Rain to the sofa and placed pillows on one side to secure her while she took the cradle upstairs to the master bedroom. She came back for the baby, a fresh bottle, and a stack of diapers, and retreated to the bedroom, going about her business as quietly as she could. Later, she realized how unnecessary the courtesy had been. In the morning, the door to the guest room stood open. The bed was unmade, and there was no sign of the few belongings Shelley had brought into the house with her.
Puzzled, Deborah carried Rain downstairs and peered out the kitchen window. The big yellow school bus was gone. Chapter 7. Thursday afternoon, April 7th, 1988. I'd swung by Sutton's place to pick him up on the way over to Ramona Road. Gone was the dress shirt and tie. He'd changed into jeans, a red sweatshirt, and scuffed running shoes. I counted 15 houses on my